There was a Christmas a few years ago where it ended up my brothers and I were decorating the tree, and their wives and my husband were sitting, like, watching us and talking about how weird we are and how we have disturbing prehensile toes.
Readers and listeners,
oh my gosh, Carrie, I have disturbing prehensile toes too.
About the oh my god, that's amazing. Let's go pick things up with our toes right now.
And I'm Marie. Carrie, what did we read this week?
This week we read a book that I brought to the podcast, The Unlikely Romance of Kate Bjorkman by Louise Plummer. Now, I discovered this book when my friend Jill sent me a fabulous care package / birthday present maybe about 12 years ago, and it was full of toys and fun little tchotchkes and Babysitter's Club books and also this book, which I had never heard of, and thought, well, if Jill sent it to me, it must be good, and then read and loved, and it's become part of my holiday canon. So there, I've tipped my hat about how I feel about this book. What did you think of it?
I really enjoyed this book. I discovered this book through you. You mentioned it last Christmas, and it was sort of like brewing in the back of my head, and I think it's been chilling out on my Amazon wish list ever since. And then you suggested doing it for the podcast, and I was like, yeah, it gives me an excuse to finally sit down and read it.
Yay. Well, I think it's my turn this week to give a summary. And although I am never as prepared as you are for this, I'll do my best.
Prepared.
Were those sarcastic quotes or scare quotes?
Those were scare quotes. And I would like to note that the Italian cover of this book is fantastic.
Ooh. Okay, we'll have to put some pictures in the show notes. I have the cover where she's sitting on the pond with her skates, and it just looks like, you know, Mallory Pike on a day in the winter.
It's a very 1995 cover, so this book is 22 years old.
Was it really published in 95?
According to Goodreads, yes.
Okay.
And that is the earliest publication date I can find.
I'm guessing it was written a little before then. It feels so 1990 to 1991. All the references to, like, Jim Henson and to the United
yes.
Germany. And yeah, it feels like 91 rather than 95. This is not the world of grunge or the world of post-grunge as we were in 1995. Irony had not made it to Minnesota yet.
It's not the world of Bill Clinton in America Online.
Oh, definitely not. So, summary of this book. Kate Bjorkman is one of the last people you might expect to have a storybook fairy tale romance with a super hot guy, just because she's super bookish and very awkward in many ways. But she lives a storybook life with her family, especially at Christmas time. And when her brother comes home bearing gifts and also some guests, she ends up having that amazing fairy tale romance she's always wanted with the boy of her dreams, her brother's best friend. Things get a little complicated when her former best friend, Ashley, gets involved and decides to assert herself in the way we've seen other girls in other books on this podcast do, decides to see what she can do about making this boy hers. There's a happy ending, though, because it's a happy Christmas book, and there's a lot of great Christmas stuff in it, and it's all framed in a completely delightful way because Kate is a writer and is recording the story of her romance as a romance novel. And she does this all with very funny asides to the reader, revision notes, and critiques from family and friends.
It's a very good book. And one of the things I love about it is it has that sort of naively sophisticated narrator I feel we don't get to see a lot of in
yes.
young adult books nowadays.
Oh my God, that's a perfect way to put it.
you know, the kind of heroine Paula Danziger and Ellen Conford would have. You know, you'd have your smart girl without too many worries in the world, because as far as they knew, the world wasn't falling apart yet. And, you know, their focus is on their future and their love lives and their best friends, as opposed to the ways the world is literally on fire.
Yep. Yeah, we don't get those girls anymore in books, because I don't think girls get to be those kinds of girls anymore. Look at Teen Vogue now compared to Seventeen magazine around the time this book came out.
See, Seventeen magazine, a little, because I started reading about 96, 97. It was trying, but the things it would publish would still be upholding the status quo. So there, It Happened to Me, Colin, there was one about a girl who was overweight, and she found that her other friends would be flirted with, but boys didn't flirt with her. They just thought she was funny. So she went to fat camp. And I remember it ended on, "I get to flirt with boys now, but I can do it in a bikini." And I'm like, meh. Oh, thank God kids have Teen Vogue nowadays.
Oh, bless Teen Vogue. We had Sassy back in the day. By the time this book was published, Sassy was on its way out. So thanks a lot, Jane Pratt.
If you would like to learn more about the rise and fall of Sassy, How Sassy Changed My Life is a very interesting book and definitely worth a look.
Yeah, I really enjoyed that one, even as someone who was a 17 subscriber, because I never thought I was quite cool enough for Sassy. I always liked Sassy, but I had a feeling that if I tried to subscribe to it, they would reject me.
Aww, Carrie.
I was a complex young preteen. So, Kate, we were talking about Kate as narrator, and I loved what you said.
She's naively sophisticated.
Yes. Yeah, she does have one of my favorite voices, I think, in all of YA Lit. She's charming from the first sentence. And I really enjoy spending that time with her.
She is incredibly funny, and she has a very strong sense of self. I hesitate to say confident, because there are definitely things about herself that she feels less than confident about, but she does know who she is and where she is in the world.
Yeah. And, you know, she's accepted the things about her that she might feel self-conscious about. The fact that she's like 6 foot tall. Like, she just says it straight up. And the fact that she is in the Midwest and it's horribly cold. And they're just great passages of her describing what in someone else's hands might be a perfect, sexy, romantic moment. And she's like, "I'm 6 feet tall. He's 6'4". And, you know, we're both wearing 1,000 layers. So it's sexy to me, but and now my glasses are broken.
Having been there, that is like the worst moment, when you put your hands down on a pair of glasses and they break from under you and you don't have a replacement.
I am so terrified of that ever happening to me. It hasn't yet.
So Kate Bjorkman has a very interesting academic and, I want to say romantic, but not in a literary romantic fashion. It's a family with a lot of traditions.
Yeah, I keep coming back to idyllic.
Yes. Kate's father is a linguistics professor. Her mother is an interior designer. And it's one of the fun asides. She said, like, "This book makes it seem like my mom does nothing but take care of the house. She's an interior designer. These are her 2 weeks off. I didn't know how to put that in."
And her father comes in and kind of tries to save his own face in the book and points out, "I do more than like sleep and lust after young women, by the way, most of the time."
It's one of the things I really loved about this book was that Woody Allen is mentioned as a creep.
Yes!
And I, like, thank you, Louise Plummer. So, plot. Plot is a thing that happens in the unlikely romance of Kate Bjorkman.
Yeah, it sure does. I feel like I come across on this podcast as hating all women. Because I do fixate on the books where there's like the horrible best friend. And it's only because I've had too many of those. Not right now. Hi, Tess. I love you. But in the past, I have had too many Ashleys / Gwyns in my life.
Let's just say that there is an incident in my life that I am pretty sure the outcome of which is going to show up on my favorite murder.
Interesting.
When your ex takes on an apprentice ex, it's never a good look for either of them.
Oh, God. No. No, you've told me a little bit about that before, and that's... No. No, thank you.
And meanwhile, I have my Shannon, who is, like, my best friend Jency, in the background, probably calling them much worse names than Empress Palpatine and Anakin Skywalker.
I want a sequel to this book someday where we get to see Kate and Shannon hanging out.
Yes.
Poor Shannon has the misfortune to be out of town while all this is happening. Shannon is Kate's actual best friend, as opposed to her ex-best friend, Ashley, who happens to be home and hanging around the house. And Shannon, like Kate's dad, comes back later and is like, you know, how come I'm not even in this book? I'm your best friend, and I'm even helping you edit it. Where am I, Kate? And Kate's like, you were out of town. So let's have a sequel. Let's have a summer break of Kate Bjorkman. Let's travel back to 1990 whatever and relive those golden, heady days.
The days before the internet.
Yeah, do they even use computers in this book?
A word processor.
That's right! She writes a paper on a word processor.
She does her research from actual books and papers at her actual university library. Although she is a senior in this book.
Oh, right. Well, they live in a university town. And, and with her dad as a professor, my mom, until this past summer, was a college professor. Now she is retired and filling up her days with meetings. But I spent a lot of time doing research at the college library when I was in high school because I had access to it and it's where the better books were.
Nice.
Yeah. Got to take advantage of interlibrary loan through all the colleges in Maryland, and I got to have pretty much every scholarly work on Jane Austen that I needed.
Nice.
For my senior project, yeah. I can use Jane Austen as a segue. We can talk about romance. So this book is a romance novel in progress, and when we talked about it over this past week, we talked about romance conventions and how they've changed. Now, my experience with romance novels kind of begins and ends right around the time that this book was most likely written and then published, just borrowing them from my friends or trading them around at, I want to say summer camp because it'll make it so much easier, but I'm going to have to say outdoor school because that's what it was. Like summer camp, except in the winter and with school. Outdoor school was where I really had my first exposure because I was sharing a bunk with my friend Amy, who was a huge romance novel fan. And that was where I got my first taste of horribly written sex scenes and all that sort of stuff, that whole kind of rite of passage thing. So Kate's descriptions of, well, in a real romance novel, it would be like this, and in a real romance novel, I'd describe it this way. All of that felt familiar to me because it was very early 90s romance novels. But you do a lot of romance reading and a lot of genre reading in general, so maybe you can talk a little bit about how you found this aspect of the book and what's changed since it was written.
So it's very funny because this is written in the like depths of the Fabio romance books. And, you know, I am always of the feeling that romance is something women write and things that women write for women have value. But I will say that what is being written nowadays, like, there are so many romance writers who are not only writing books by women for women, they are coming at things from a feminist standpoint. They are writing about heroines, different races, different abilities, different backgrounds, exploring all these areas of history and all these different kinds of romance within the romance framework, which we can talk about a little bit in regards to this book. And there are some things which haven't changed, especially in that romance readers expect a happy ending.
You teased some elaboration there. I say go ahead and elaborate.
So January of this year, Tessa Dare had one of her books on sale for 99 cents, and goodness knows I am a sucker for a 99 cent ebook. It's called Romancing the Duke in the Castles Ever After series. As the daughter of a famed author, Isolde Ophelia Goodnight grew up on tales of brave knights and fair maidens. She never doubted romance would be in her future, too. The storybooks offered endless possibilities, and as she grew older, Izzy crossed them off, one by one. Ugly duckling turned swan, abducted by a handsome highwayman, rescued from drudgery by a charming prince. No. Now Izzy's given up yearning for romance. She'll settle for a roof over her head. What fairy tales are left over for an impoverished 26-year-old woman who's never been kissed? This one. So this is a story of what happens when you inherit a castle, which comes with a cranky duke and a whole bunch of knights and ladies cosplayers.
Sounds so good.
Tessa Dare is so funny, and she's so nice on Twitter. I read that book, and then I read 8 more, and I only have 2 more of her books currently in print to read, and it's breaking my heart. And from there, like, it was this one book, like any one good book can open you up to a new genre. You know, I had read queer romance, but that's sort of, it has its own structure. It has its own tropes. So like your typical het romance via Harlequin or Avon Flame, it's something I had never tried before. But after this, and after reading Tessa Dare's writing and seeing who she was as a person, and that she was somebody who championed the rights of women and all sorts of good politics while writing what are charmingly and affectionately called kissing books, opened up a whole new world for me. And from Tessa Dare, I started reading Courtney Milan, and I just started reading Beverly Jenkins, and I'm having a lot of fun.
That is awesome. Those sound like very, very good people to check out.
I'll put lots of links in the show notes. Do we want to talk about the characters in the book?
We started talking a little bit about the family. We talked about her parents. Now, I mentioned when I was summarizing that her brother comes to stay for the holidays and brings some people along. Do we want to talk about Bjorn and his entourage?
Yes.
Which I guess is an unfair way to refer to his wife and his best friend and then another friend. But he really does kind of like arrive at the house with a whole bunch of people and say, surprise, Christmas.
It gave me shades of Christmas with the Cranks, which is a movie that makes me really, really angry.
See, here's the other way to think of it. Muppet Family Christmas.
Oh, okay. Now I feel better.
Yeah, except that no one was planning to learn how to surf. So, and nobody sleeps on coat hangers that we know of.
And nobody was going to cook one of the guests.
As I say, every single year, no one ever talks enough about the time the Swedish chef almost murdered Big Bird and served him to every single Muppet in existence.
My goodness. Oh my gosh, poor Jim Henson has a cameo in this. It's one of my favorite lines one of my favorite heartbreak scenes in a novel to date. So Bjorn shows up with his wife Trish, who is an aspiring Annie Leibovitz, his best friend from childhood Richard, and Richard's friend Fleur. So the novel, and Kate is 100% acknowledging this, Fleur is set up to be the antagonist, because she is a stunningly beautiful girl. She's arrived with this young man. The mother is openly talking about, should we put them in the same bedroom? I guess we'll put them in bedrooms next to each other and maybe they'll find each other.
They'll find each other if they want to.
Which is the thing, again, I can't see that happening in a modern YA. And I don't know if it's sort of the post-AIDS era or... I was raised Catholic. I often tell my father about my living arrangements. It's not living in sin if you're not sinning. I mean, what else am I going to tell him? What is my other option?
So...
Her brother is married and married very young. He's a junior in college, correct?
I think so, yeah. That just blows my mind. And, you know, what Kate says is Bjorn makes up his mind to do things and then he does them. And so he knew Trish was right for him and then they got married. But I just think about where I was at 20 and... Like, 2 years later, yes, I met the man who is now my husband, but those 2 years, I think, were pretty big years where I grew a lot into an adult, and 20-year-old me should not have been married to anybody.
Right. I tend to get engaged or pseudo-engaged in, like, 4 to 5 year increments, although I think after the last one, it will come in time as opposed to, it will happen. My dad likes to say everything in its own time.
Yes. The Indigo Girls like to say that too.
I'll have to bring that up with him. Yeah, my dad doesn't listen to this. My dad, was starting, like, he's got, they're not girlfriends because he's in his late 60s, but there's two women he kind of pals around with. And palling around with multiple women when you're in your 60s is not considered polyamory. I'm so glad my dad isn't listening to this.
I deliberately haven't told my mom that this exists, so... But all of her friends are on Facebook, so things make their way to her.
So once he and I were doing some cleaning around the house, and this is when I think when he started seeing this woman, and he was saying, Marie, I have to go, we'll call her Faye Dunaway. And that's just the first name that came to mind. It's like, I gotta go talk to the pastor. I'm like, what do you have to talk to him about? What's up? He's like, I have to talk to him about Faye. I'm like, what about? He's like, I've gotta talk to him about Faye. And I'm like, Dad, I think I know what you're getting at, and you don't want to say these things to me because I'm your daughter. But the priest is going to have exactly the same answer you think he's going to have.
Yeah.
This is why I didn't come out until I was 29.
Yep. Oh, Catholicism, you're so much fun.
Hey, we're so much fun that the Bjorkmans went to a cathedral for Christmas Eve for Midnight Mass.
That's true, although they are quick to point out that none of them are Catholic. I've actually never been to Midnight Mass.
I haven't either. My dad ushers it every year, and that's when Nikki and I stay up late, play with our gifts, and eat leftover heated up rice balls and watch crazy Christmas specials. It's a lot of fun.
Oh, that sounds very similar to very similar to my Christmas experience. And I think those are things that we'll talk about this week and also next week. So we've got Bjorn, we've got Trish, and then we've got Richard.
Richard is this very sexy 90s hunk who is also compassionate and kind and has grown up with Kate. And thus, Kate assumes she's always going to be the annoying little sister.
But of course, she dreams of one day his looking at her and seeing the woman she's become and falling deeply in love. And the thing is, that's what happens.
You know, there's this sort of romantic interest that I see, like, very particular to, like, 80s and 90s young adult books. And he is, like, he hits all the check marks. He's got good hair. He's got nice thighs. He's really smart. He is definitely very in command of himself. He does not like to show weakness at all.
Yeah.
He looks kind of... go ahead.
Oh, no. What were you going to say he looks like?
Richard Gere.
Yes. Yeah. That's every... You're so right. That's like every 80s and 90s
but I
romantic
might be...
interest in YA lit.
But
generic
I might be thinking...
Richard Gere.
I think I'm thinking of Just As Long As We're Together. And
yeah. Benjamin.
Benjamin Moore. So if you haven't read that book, and if you love Judy Blume and you haven't, you should. The heroine of that book has a poster of young Richard Gere, because at that time he was starting to become the Silver Fox. That was also published in like the mid-90s.
Mid-80s.
Mid-80s, okay.
Yeah, because I read it in fourth grade.
Gotcha. Okay, because I have the mid-90s republishing of it. And I think they updated some stuff.
Oh, when Here's You, Rachel Robinson came out.
Yeah, that would make sense.
Yeah.
And we are being teased when eventually there will be an Allison book. But
Allison book?
Oh, Judy. Judy, don't leave us hanging.
Yeah. Stay alive, Judy. Write the Allison book.
Judy, who is a wonderful, brave woman and a cancer survivor and one of my formative authors.
Oh my
and
God, yes.
If you like this book, or conversely, if you like Judy Blume, you should read this book because they have a very similar kind of comic timing.
Yeah, Judy Blume and, as you said earlier, Paula Danziger and Ellen Conford. When I read this book, I was in my like mid to late 20s and... reading it, even though I'd never read it before, felt so familiar because it felt like all the teen romantic comedy books that I had devoured in my early adolescence.
I read a lot of 80s and early 90s romance books when I was a preteen to young teenager, and then I read Weetzie Bat and kind of went off the deep edge and read basically all magical realism and weird stuff from then on. I was lucky that I got to read a lot of funny stuff by Paula Danziger and Ellen Conford and sort of approach romance with a sense of humor as opposed to you taking it all too seriously because, you know, my hormones and my emotions wanted to make everything incredibly serious, and there's nothing serious about teenage boys.
Exactly. One of the things Kate says in the book is something about a sense of humor and laughter being the best aphrodisiacs. And I think that's
it's
very true. That's
line.
The ending line.
It's so
yes.
Good.
And it's so true. It's so perfect.
If anybody was going to ask me what romance in my 30s was like, I'd say you laugh a lot, you talk about money a lot, and you get comfortable farting in front of each other.
Farting was exactly what I was going to say. But then I thought, is that one of those things that's just because of what I do for a living? Like, just, I'm very comfortable with any and all weird bodily functions and have been for a long time because it's just what I deal with all day long.
I don't work with kids, but I foster kittens. A thing they don't tell you about kittens. And I think I've mentioned this on previous episodes, but just reiterating, kittens fart a lot.
But they fart rainbows, right?
Oh, yeah. Stinky rainbows.
Yeah.
So, kids, family, and friends all get together for Christmas. So let's talk about Fleur and who she is and why she is.
So she's not the antagonist that she's at first teased to be. She ends up being a really great friend and ally for Kate. And turns out to be like super crazy smart and helps Kate with her paper on Othello and introduces her to the wonderful world of feminist criticism. They have a lot of great geeky conversations together. She helps Kate get pretty and gussied up for fancy Christmas dinner in a way that very much a contrast to how Ashley kind of tries to outshine Kate. Even when she says she's helping Kate, I think she makes Kate even more awkward. And I'm willing to bet that she does some of that on purpose.
I agree.
Yeah. So what did you tell me about Fleur when you messaged me about her the other day?
Fleur is definitely gay and has a very strong sense of self.
So readers and listeners, if you'll remember back to Boy Meets Boy, that is what the protagonist of that story took home on his report card in kindergarten. And it's a perfect description of Fleur, too. Although it's never stated outright, Fleur is definitely gay.
So the toast, may it rest in peace. There was a wonderful article called Code Word for Lesbianism and Classic Films. And in your 80s and 90s, young adult, not interested in boys and feminist criticism, those are your keywords.
She's not interested in Richard, and she's not interested in marriage. But from those two, you can make that assumption. Because who wouldn't be interested in Richard? He probably looked like Richard Gere. And he has a sexy voice, we're told. Because one of his not-so-flattering nicknames among their friends is Mr. Radio. And as Ashley is quick to point out, he's got really great thighs.
That's something I also kind of miss in modern YA. I feel there's a frankness about attraction to bodies that we don't see as much of. Like, I can think of Sid Charisse, like Rachel Cohn heroines, and that's it. But readers and listeners, I'm probably wrong. You should tell me how wrong I am.
Yes, please do. Mm-hmm. Tell Marie she's wrong. I mean, yes, teach us things. Something supportive like that. Fleur is awesome. And from the bits we get of Shannon, I think Shannon, Kate's real best friend, seems to be pretty awesome too.
Now, Trish and Bjorn are having some issues in their relationship, as one would imagine a 20 and a 22-year-old would. But Kate is quick to acknowledge you may only get to see part of them. And having, you know, and having been in a 2-year relationship, by the time this comes out, it will be almost our second anniversary. The argument that they have over Christmas trees is one I can see myself having. And I am definitely a Trisha in that situation where I want a thing away and I will pout if I don't. And I'll say it's okay, but I will pout and I acknowledge this is a thing I will do and that I am trying to change that.
It's an argument that makes a lot of sense for a couple to be having during their first holiday together. It's their first Christmas, and they're arguing about what kind of tree they're going to bring home. And Trish wants it one way, and Bjorn wants it the other way. And it's that kind of huge compromise that you make when you are making a life together, that you don't get to bring everything that you loved from your life with your family or your life alone. You make compromises and you make your own traditions. And I say this, and I will admit that I have not had to do too much of that in the way of Christmas traditions because, of course, my husband is Jewish. And so Christmas is a thing where I say, now we do this. And my brothers are pretty much the same way with their spouses. I feel bad. I feel bad for our spouses at Christmas because they didn't know what they were getting into when they married us. They didn't know that they would have to deal with the monstrosity that is the Christmas tree in my mom's basement. They did not know how many Rankin Bass specials they would be forced to watch.
So one of the things that the Celevi family looks forward to is the Something Awful Christmas album that Nikki and I play during Christmas dinner and wait to see which family member notices something is awry first. Now, I have introduced Carrie to several of these songs, and it is a new, sure, Celevi Christmas tradition that it's not Christmas until we hear, ho, 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 it's Christmas time.
Listen, thank you for that. I've been meaning to sit down and, you know, when I have a moment to fully digest, ho, 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 it's Christmas time. But oh, once I do, you are getting rock and roll Santa in your inbox. Just you wait.
Amazing.
And Santa's going to Kokomo. You laugh, but it's a real thing.
Oh my God.
The Unlikely Romance of Kate Bjorkman is a book that we are reading this week.
So I was going to talk a little bit about Kate's Scandinavian roots and their Christmas traditions and how the things that make her Christmas so delightful are things which are very trendy right now.
Yeah, I found that really interesting reading this, that it was very much, I know it's not awooga, but I always have to pronounce it awooga in my head, add that extra A to make the horn honking sound.
I know I'm a phonetic reader, so it's really hard to remember that.
That it's not
I'm doing it. So if I ever spell your name wrong, it's not because I don't remember. It's because I hear it in my head and it comes out my fingers.
Yep.
Sorry, kids. I was hooked on phonics. I'm doing my best. So Kate's family, for the first time, one of the things that Bjorn notes, like when he walks into the house, is why is there a tiny Christmas tree on the piano? And the mom says, because you're not here, because I can do what I want, because one of my birds is out of the nest. Give me a break. Not like that. She's actually quite charming. And, you know, Bjorn, you know, thankfully decides, I want a big tree. So he goes out and he gets the big tree. Their family does lots of baking. And Fleur is so charmed by this that she's like, why don't we make a Christmas cookbook? And she and Kate's mom start working on it. It's a nice project for her, especially since Fleur has such rocky relationships with her own parents. And that's one of the reasons she came to stay with the Bjorkmans, to see if this kind of fairy tale Christmas actually existed.
Right. She says at one point, Rich told me that there was a magical place where George Bailey and his family still lived. And I thought that was a very sweet way of describing what goes on in the Bjorkman household at Christmas time. And I also thought that, you know, Bjorn describes it really well when he's talking about just how special your own home can seem when you come back to it after a long time. The first Christmas coming back to my parents' home when I was in college was like, oh, wow, my family is really great. And I mean, that lasted about a week. And then it was, get me back to school. My mom's driving me crazy. But yeah, that sense of nostalgia and the renewed appreciation for people and traditions that you've grown up with and have taken for granted.
Yep, there's some feels right there.
Yep, yep.
Yeah, Christmas isn't the same without Mom. Had to get a dead parent remark in there somewhere.
Yep, well, Christmas was one of my dad's jams. My dad was Santa Claus, so it's been a weird few years without Santa.
I mean, I feel like we have done our best in creating our own traditions, and they are a lot of fun. But there is the part of me that kind of wishes I had gotten to know my mom as an adult, and I could call her and ask her advice on things and get advice I don't really want and probably won't listen to, but the thought would be there.
Exactly.
I also got my style and penchant for decorating, which is one of the things I do have to, you know, compromise on in my relationship, because Hannah has a very minimalistic and elegant style. And I once went ornament shopping with my dad, and I was picking things out, and he remarked, "Maria, it's a Christmas tree, not a drag queen."
Should we talk about grand romantic gestures?
Yes.
First of all, we've said this before, don't make them. Grand romantic gestures that look really good on paper and in the movies, they're invariably creepy and strange and off-putting when they happen in real life.
Unless you're actually in a relationship.
And even then.
Yeah.
I don't want anyone waking me up in the middle of the night playing Peter Gabriel songs at me. I need my sleep.
That's fair. You work with tiny children.
There are several grand romantic gestures in this book, and there's a lot of critique of them, which in a romance novel, I appreciated.
It's also really refreshing how in this book, and it does kind of follow the what they call the beats of a romance novel, because romance novels have a very particular structure, and I'm going to recommend the book Romancing the Beat by, let me pull up the tab with her name, Gwen Hayes. If you want to, if you like writing, or if you just want to learn more about how books are structured, it's super fun, and she uses 80 songs to illustrate the different steps that go into the structure of a romance novel. And it's
that
really fun.
Like a blast.
So we hit about the halfway mark, and that's when the character, you know, when Richard and Kate figure out they have feelings for each other, and they tell each other very directly. And it's really nice, because that's usually takes an entire book in an 80s or 90s romance novel.
Yeah, it is nice to be a direct person falling in love with another direct person. I mean, so I've been told. So I saw in this book.
I mean, I am usually that direct person, but it took a long time to get there. And I have done my share of creepy romantic gestures. But I would like to think they have been tempered by this point.
I mean, I'll just skip ahead and say, like, big climax of this book involves Richard doing something totally ridiculous to try and win Kate back, because this is the part of the romance novel. This is the beat where our couple is in jeopardy and the hero's got to do something to save the day. And I forget about it every time I read this book, and then I get there and I want to like throw the book across the room because it's so dumb and it's so manipulative.
I like my coffee like I like my men iced.
It's like so manipulative and stupid.
I mean, I love how Kate is complaining earlier in a novel that her brother and his wife make up because she, he sends her a dozen red roses. And Kate's like, that is such a cliche. I can't believe she fell for it. For me, it would have to be a dozen lilies. Like, that's such an 18-year-old.
Yeah.
So cute.
And her parents have a similar story that involves her dad getting in a bathtub fully clothed. And, you know, Kate rolls her eyes at this as well. And then she has her own moment being faced with a grand romantic gesture, and it works. But there's an epilogue to this book that I appreciate greatly every time I reread it. And since it's still a happy romance novel, there aren't too many details about this, but Kate talks about how she and Richard have discussions together and work on compromises, and the grand romantic gesture did not fix everything. They are still two people who are in love several months after the events of the novel, but are working to figure it all out and figuring out what a relationship is and what it means to be together.
But there is something that she never addresses. So Richard and Kate figure out they like each other. They have a very romantic skating date where Kate gets her three-paragraph kiss that she realizes she really wants to only describe in a sentence or two. But Ashley has already asked Richard to a New Year's Eve dance at Kate's aunt's house. So Kate goes with her German exchange student friend, and they talk linguistics the entire time. When Kate goes off, as one does, to further the plot, she discovers Ashley kissing Richard in a way that's described as sexual assault, because women can sexually assault men. Mm-hmm. Yep. And because this is a book from 1995, Kate gets upset with Richard and blames him.
Yeah.
And all of this is, all of her feelings about this are addressed as her blaming him and her anger towards him.
Yes. That's a really good point.
And as much as I do love Kate's wallowing, that is something I felt the need to address in the era of hashtag Me Too.
Yes. When Kate does address, at least in her mind, Ashley's part in it, it's more, how could Ashley seduce Richard away from me? It's more about her and Ashley rather than realizing that, you know, Richard was kind of assaulted back there.
Mm-hmm. Sorry, bring the mood down. Merry Christmas.
It's either that or talk about the dead English teacher.
Yeah, the dead English teacher that gets a line in the story.
The dead English teacher gets quite a few lines. He shows up a lot.
He does show up a lot in her mind, but it's sort of his death is mentioned as an aside.
Yeah, in an aside of, like, well, this is awkward. I've always thought that was a really interesting decision to weave in the story of this English teacher that Kate and her brother and Richard had, who was also their neighbor and their tennis coach and just a really important figure in their lives. And he's dying of cancer and passes away during the holidays or shortly thereafter. I can't
shortly
remember.
Thereafter.
Shortly thereafter, yeah. And it's an interesting choice to have that going on in what's otherwise, you know, the coziest Christmas in Cozy Town.
Full of hygge. So readers and listeners, if you don't know what this is, so hygge is a Danish concept, and it is one of those slightly indefinable words, but as Hannah puts it, I think it's just another word for cozy.
Yes.
It is a feeling that comes when you are warm inside and you're surrounded by candles and soft things and eating something delicious and watching a good nostalgic movie.
With people you love.
Yes.
Or by yourself, happily alone. But company seems to be a big part of it. Some grumpy person I saw on the internet described it as sitting around with all your friends burning candles and talking about how nice it is to be sitting around with all your friends burning candles.
I hate fun.
I know. That's basically, I think it was an Amazon reviewer. But so, I mean, that tells you everything you need to know. But yeah, people who hate fun do not enjoy Uga or Uga. The H is silent, or is it? I don't know. A Wooga.
Now, it's interesting that the Swedish have a term, and I learned this from the cover of a book and also some quick Googling, called, I'm going to do my best to pronounce it, lagom, which is everything being balanced and not too much and not too little. And I feel that the Christmas in this book really does encompass this, because it's not a lavish Christmas. It's not needlessly ascetic. it is just enough of everything. It's just enough of each other's company. It's going to church and having a good dinner with seven fishes, but not like how my people have seven fishes.
Fish on Christmas. That's just insane.
We fry, they lie. Let me tell you, there's nothing like, so I'm half Sicilian. My dad's side is Sicilian. And Sicilian and Italian are two different things.
Yes, they are.
And
I've learned anything from my Italian friends.
So there's a delicious Italian dessert called a zeppoli, which is a ball of fried dough. Now there's also a allegedly delicious Italian appetizer, which is fish in a ball of fried dough. Guess how this story ends?
Oh, no.
Yeah, 7-year-old me was really traumatized.
Oh, God.
When you bite into a donut and you find an anchovy.
All things involving fish are pretty traumatizing to me. So that sounds like the worst Christmas ever.
Yeah, so it is a delightfully described Christmas, and it really is a delightful book.
It is. It's a nice change after the horrors of Christmas that we were put through and subsequently put you through last week with Rebel Angels. And I think we are going to continue for another week before we take our Christmas break or our midwinter holiday break.
Happy Saturnalia.
And happy first night of Hanukkah.
Hello.
Because that's when you're listening to this.
Hello, Jewish readers and listeners. So this is what happens when Marie has a calendar like for books, but does not consider the calendar for publication. Happy first night of Hanukkah to our Jewish readers and listeners. We love you guys. We bring offerings to Leviathan. And I wanted to talk about some awesome Jewish authors and Jewish rep and books that I've been reading and I am about to read and that you may enjoy as well. So a very unique reading memoir is How to Be a Heroine by Samantha Ellis, who is Iraqi and Jewish and has a very warm, loving, and unique family. She talks about all of the authors and heroines that she read growing up and how they shaped her into the person she is. I have heard wonderful things about Becky Albertelli's The Upside of Unrequited, which has awesome queer rep, awesome Jewish rep, and awesome fat rep. Sounds like a keeper. Definitely check it out. And also, kudos to Shira Glassman, who is like single-handedly upholding the queer Jewish fantasy genre with her Mango Universe books and is writing some really amazing like contemporary queer and het romance. Definitely check her books out as well.
That is awesome. Thanks for doing that research and helping to make this month a little less Christmas-centric. We'll try to do better about that next year as well. Right now, I'm feeling kind of like a band conductor who really poorly planned their holiday concert and is just searching for like the one copy in the school of I Had a Little Dreidel. Because, oh yeah, we have to do something for that kid who plays euphonium over there.
Do y'all remember?
His mom will yell at me.
Was it in Blubber where they do the holiday pageant about a Jewish and Christian family that does songs and dances about the two holidays, and the narrator is saying that it's sort of an incomplete mashup, but at least they're trying?
I think that's in Just As Long As We're Together, actually.
Right. Judy
because
Bloom,
the hot boy plays the husband, right?
Right.
Thank you, Judy Blume.
You shaped so much of who we are.
I know.
And I really don't even mind about learning about Santa from you. I couldn't have learned it from a better person. You too?
If I had to have it confirmed, because I was 10 and I was hanging on to dear life that, you know, maybe this one thing wouldn't be spoiled in the world. If I had to learn it from anyone and have it confirmed by anyone, I'm really glad it was Judy Blume.
I was 7 and it was going to be Nikki's second Christmas, so I had to pretend for a lot longer.
Yeah.
If memory serves, he pulled a fudge on us.
Oh, nice. Of course. Of course he did. I always suspected that my youngest brother was fudging it as well.
Oh, my goodness. So, Carrie, do you have any read-alikes?
I picked one for this week. It is Dash and Lily's Book of Dares by Rachel Cohn and the Leviathan himself, David Levithan. And I picked this one as a read-alike for Kate Bjorkman because I think Lily would get along very well in the Bjorkman household. And because I think the cynicism that Dash brings in his narration is very similar to the kind of snarkiness that Kate brings to her treatment of the romance novel. So this is likely a book that you've read where Kate is one that you probably haven't, but, you know, it can be a reverse read-alike if you want. If you've already read Dash and Lily and you enjoyed it a lot, check out Kate.
And if you haven't read either, read both because they're good.
Yeah, they're both a lot of fun. So, Marie, what's your read-alike for this week?
I have two. And they are both of the era of Kate Bjorkman. So my read-alikes are Remember Me to Harold Square by Paula Danziger. And 7 Days to a Brand New Me by Ellen Conford.
Yes! Oh my god, perfect!
I will assume you've read the Danziger. Have you read the Conford?
Yes, not for a very long time, but I did read pretty much everything she wrote.
If you're looking to read her nowadays, thanks to the amazing Lizzie Skernick, and may Lizzie Skernick books rest in peace, you can still get your hands on them. There are still 2 Ellen Conford books still in print, and This Is Laura, and With Love from Sylvie. And I do recommend reading them because she's awesome. And Paula Danziger, of course, is eternal, and the Danziger Award for Humorous Children's Fiction is a go, and yay. I bet the results are going to be fantastic.
That is awesome. Anything keeping Paula's name alive is good for me because she was so important to me when I was growing up.
So were you a Marcy Books or a Matthew Martin Books?
I don't even know what the latter is.
Interesting. The Matthew Martin, I think it's a quadrology or a quintology about a preteen boy and his eccentric family. And they're delightful. Definitely read
were
them.
Were these?
It starts with everyone else's
parents. Were these published around the same time as like the Amber Brown books?
Slightly before.
Okay, so this is long after I'd aged out.
Yes.
Of reading about preteen boys.
Yes.
But I was definitely, I loved the books about Marcy. I loved The Divorce Express and Aardvark Eat Turtle World, Pistachio Prescription, and Can You Sue Your Parents for Malpractice? I still have all of those and love them.
The books are as good as their titles.
Yes.
Carrie, what are you reading now?
Well, I just finished reading Genuine Fraud by E. Lockhart. It's her latest suspense novel, and I tore through it. It was great. It's kind of like the teen girl version of The Talented Mr. Ripley.
Ooh.
And it's told out of order. It's told backwards. So that's interesting, too. It's very very suspenseful and engaging and creepy. And I highly recommend it. What are you currently reading?
I just finished Anne of Windy Poplars by Ella Montgomery. It is the first time I've read it. I've read all the other books in the Anne series many, many times. But something about this one, it got harder to get through. I think it was the second to last published of the series, and it was written long after the rest of the series, so it has a different feel to it. And you can definitely... Anne is much snarkier and a much more strong-minded heroine in this one. And there's also a lot of little asides that show that the author was a little tired of the character as well. But it does give you all of the features of a classic Anne story. There's meddling in romances, there are precocious kids, there's wonderful old ladies, and there's beautiful Prince Edward Island.
Yay, that's one that I haven't been able to make it all the way through since my first reading, which was maybe 25 years ago. It might be time for a reread.
Because everything is related, I just learned, because I've been reading her blog, that Louise Plummer moved to Nova Scotia.
And hopefully she is spreading the joy of Christmas there.
Yes. Okay, so do we have any housekeeping?
You can find us online at Go Your Own YA in all the usual places. Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and all those things. You can get in touch with us at our email address, which I can't remember at the moment.
GoYourOwnYA@gmail.com.
That seems very simple to remember. I'm not sure why that was so hard for me to do.
We're done, readers and listeners. This has been Go Your Own YA.
It sure has. The person who says that says their name. And then the next person says, and I'm the other person.
We need a website like they have for My Favorite Murder, where they say whose turn it is to go
next.
Oh
my God.
For when Steven,
amazing.
For when Steven doesn't remember. Right, readers and listeners, this is Go Your Own YA. I'm Marie.
And I'm Carrie.
Do something good for yourself.
And bad for the patriarchy.
Good night.
And good for the Jews. Happy Hanukkah!